Welcome to the Coaches Forum by These Football Times, a podcast for the progressive football coach, the inquisitive mind, and the lifelong learner for all things football, with your host, John Townsend.
Welcome to the Coaches Forum hosted by These Football Times. I'm your host, John Townsend. Today I'm very excited to bring on a guest that I've played for, and somebody that I've kept in contact with over the years, which I think is a very important aspect of coaching. This man is named Matt Wilkerson. Matt's journey to the game is not only intriguing, but he's somebody that I refer to as a player's coach. Matt has coached at essentially every level in the U.S. game, and his journey since his playing career ended right as his professional career started is also very interesting. He is someone who has influenced many people, myself included, along the way. Of course, as we get into Matt's story, I'm going to let him talk for himself. But I think his journey and his career in coaching has some unique life lessons. What I will say, however, is this podcast was unlike any other that I've done at These Football Times as Coaches Forum. Seeing as that we are living in unprecedented times, we discuss aspects of the game that many of us can relate to, that we can learn from, and that we deal with in our lives away from the pitch. And those lessons that we can then pull from will help us when we go back to the sidelines or take the field again. Please make sure that you check out thesefootballtimes.co for the best long-form football journalism out there on offer, the best storytelling, some of the best writing on the internet, and be sure to check out These Football Times, the magazine. These print editions prove that print journalism is alive and well and as vibrant as ever, and these keepsakes are not only works of art, but contain some of the best writing from some of the best writers in the football writing world. Thank you, and please enjoy the episode. We begin the conversation by just catching up and talk to Matt about books that I'm reading and how much I'm reading now that we're experiencing a pandemic and there's more time on my hands. And we talk so much about learning from other avenues other than coaching material and seminars and watching games. Sometimes you pull from literature, sometimes you pull from autobiography, sometimes you pull from nonfiction or essays. So this conversation jumps right into Matt and I talking about books that I'm reading and keeping the mind active, or as he says, inactive. Enjoy.
Yeah, unprecedented times. I've been finding myself reading a lot more than I did even as a college student, as a grad student. So it's good. I mean, it's obviously to keep busy. I have my work and then, you know, the family duties, but also trying to keep the mind active and all those good things. So,
or unactive, I think.
Yeah. Today's a good day to probably unplug from a lot of things. And, I don't know how it is, in your neck of the woods, but, it is a weird time to be I guess connected through a lot of different social media platforms, and just not even just as like a coach, just as like as a person. It's just like, okay, you know, because I get caught up in it all the time, and then I'm like, why am I even doing this now? So that's one of those things where I try to manage myself and monitor what I do and how I operate, and you know, it's a fine line between having some fun and then having some some unproductive discourse, but yeah. Just doing my thing. It's interesting. I was talking to a couple of my colleagues who are coaches as well, and they were like, you know, they have either made it like a really productive time during quarantine, or they've absolutely fallen off the off the planet in terms of keeping themselves stimulated and busy. And so one of the things that I have noticed about what you've done over the years is, especially through your Instagram stories, is always having this self-dialogue that I think is really, really cool. So I've just enjoyed it from like a perspective of is observing and who's, you know, played for you, but not even as a player of yours. And I thought that was a really unique thing that you have these the stoicism and some of the things that you share, but also just your morning walks with your dogs and looking at the deer and your bike rides. I really dig that stuff, man. And I just want to let you know that that's a really cool thing. So I'm glad you're out there and enjoying that medium.
that's all. I feel the same. You know, I about reading your stuff, and you know, as much as you want to stay connected with everybody, it's impossible. We all kind of get consumed in our own lives, and you don't have enough bandwidth to connect with everyone. And I was hesitant on all social media pretty much. And it's been awesome because I feel like I know what's going on in your life. I feel like I know what's going on in Bingy's life. I feel like I know what's going on. And you feel like you're right there, you know? So yeah. it's pretty cool way to stay connected. So yeah, it's been fun to reconnect with people in that way. And it's interesting to see the comments you get from people. And, you know, some people are like, man, that I needed that today. And you're like, whoa, I didn't. That's a great side effect, I guess, you know. Yeah. So it's been fun.
You know, I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, as we get into this, I have all those questions, like, you know, mapped out and everything. We can take this any way you want. But I was really I was talking to Keeney a couple times on this podcast, and I was telling him, you know, these conversations, whether you record them or publish them or not, are for a lot of us probably long overdue, just in terms of staying, you know, connected with people who have similar interests. You know, it's not necessarily just about the coaching. It's just about the human side of the whole thing too. I think, you know, one thing I try to do with when I write about the game, when I transition from playing and the coaching and now more writing, and I still coach a little bit, but more just developing players, it's like there's this whole side of the introspection of the game that I think probably gets lost on people in this country a little bit. But I think just in general, whether it's, you know, you're pursuing soccer or piano or whatever, I think sometimes people we're conditioned to just look outward and never look inward. And I think, you know, over the years, I've had a lot of time to think about just my own journey, but also just the people that I have met through the sport and how they've evolved, and it's been interesting to see where the game is people, or how many people have left it behind, and that's okay too. So I think it's but anyway, in any event, it's really good to get you on here. I've been wanting to chat with you anyway, just, you know, whether it's a podcast or just, you know, phone call, but it's good to definitely reconnect. So
Look forward to it. Family's doing good. I see, and you're pretty big into that, I know, and that takes a lot of time. So it is. I'll never forget, and we'll probably talk about it, but this story sticks to me all the time. I know we mentioned on whatever Twitter, but it was either when you were visiting or moving in. And I'm like, what have you been up to? And you're like, yeah, you know, ran a marathon yesterday. I'm like, oh, you've been training? No, my sister was running that, needed some help. So I just did it. And I'm like, that motivates me a lot when I'm running, like, not, I can't go run 2 miles today, you know? And I'm like, come on. So, but you're right. I think, everybody evolves so much. I know I have, I mean, or tried to. It's hard to judge yourself, but.
Well, it's funny, as you know, as you mentioned family and everything, I have a whole case of like these marathon medals, and I just was looking at one of mine from like Chicago Marathon a couple of years ago, and I was like, man, this thing is like, I don't even write about running as much as I used to. And I mean, obviously soccer is my love and running is what I kind of do, but it's this weird thing where I was talking to a colleague at work. We have these weird corporate wellness things. They said, do you meditate? And I was like, no, I don't meditate. And then one of my coworkers was like, hey, do you run like all the time? And I was like, yeah, I probably do my best thinking on these long runs or even short runs where it's awful. I'm up a hill and it's like a mile run, and it's like, you could do some good thinking in, you know, 6-7 minutes that, you know, you normally wouldn't do. So, it's something that I've tried to instill in my players, and they don't get it. I don't think it's something you can really coach into them. It's a mindset that, you know, to be fair, let me talk about the marathon story, because it is one of the launching pads of my life. That my sister was an avid runner, and she just decided that she was going to do the Cincinnati Flying Pig Marathon, and I was moving into Lexington, and I was in the area, and I knew we had a fitness test coming up, and I saw what Coach Tracy put together, and I was I trained for it. I mean, the fitness test, but I had no idea how fit I was, and so I said, well, what's 26.2? I mean, it's whatever. It's just 1 mile, do another one, and do it, you know, for another 26 times. Boy, did I learned a lot about myself there. And I remember how sore I was because I think I wore a pair of soccer shorts, a pair of, like, not even running shoes, just trainers. And then probably just a cotton shirt, and I regret every ounce of that to this day. I never will run that with that attire again. So,
but you know, that's, I think, one thing about coaching, being a coach or being a player, that I think you just hit on the head, that we kind of lose when we get older, is there's a little naivety in you there, right? Like, this is easy. I can do anything. And so you just go do it instead of being hindered by the fear of failing. Yeah. And I know I experienced that so much, coaching or a player. Like, I remember the first year I coached a high school team, my own team. I knew nothing. But I didn't know what I didn't know. And, like, I got along somehow instinctively with the guys. And I think sometimes now, thinking I know a lot more kind of clutters the the paradox of choice, you know? Like,
yeah.
So it's I think a little bit of that just let it rip, no fear attitude is a huge strength when you're younger.
Yeah.
You just, you're like, I can do this. And you don't think of all the possible obstacles, and you just kind of get after it, you know?
Well, you know, it's a player that I'm currently helping. She's come back from two ACL rehabilitations, and she has seen a lot of her college offers just go. I mean, like, they're just off the list. And, you know, I explained to her, I said, injury is part of life. It's part of game. And, you know, and one of the things that we were talking about is my wife's a physical therapist. And so we're talking about, you know, regaining fitness. And she was like, yeah, I do all this running. I do this speed school. I do the weights. And I'm like, no, let's talk about, like, you know, fitness of your mind. And, like, you know, how much mental endurance do you really have? Because, you know, I can make you run 3 miles and I can go run them with you and everything like that. But it's really not about this endurance of, like, physical stuff. It's, you know, how much are you willing to let, I guess, get out of your own way type of stuff. But, you know, at a certain point, she was confronted with this opportunity to go into her first tackle after that, you know, second surgery. And she's like, you know, I just don't know. And I said, I don't think you will until you're in it. And it's kind of like, I hate saying jump into the deep end with a weighted vest on, but that's kind of, that's parenthood. That's, you know, it's coaching. That's a lot of things. You have to just take that calculated risk. And, you know, you do know what it's like to fail. Like, you know what that side's like. You can imagine what success looks like, but I don't know if you, you need to go from imagining to experiencing. And I think that's one of the things that I've learned in my life, whether it's through the game or through, you know, anything. But, yeah, I think one thing that I do remember real quick before, you know, really kick things off, which, I mean, this is perfect, is I remember looking at the track at Shively on the fitness test day. And I think me, Griff, and maybe I forgot who else may have passed that first fitness test. But I remember thinking, this is going to be hard. It's not going to be marathon hard. It's going to be a different type of hard. And I remember seeing the challenge, not so much about the fatigue aspect of it, but just the unknown, just running. You know, and again, we can, it's really not about the fitness test at all. It's just, you can look at the metrics on the paper, and you know what you trained for, you didn't train for, you know, depending on how you approached it. But once that gun went off or the whistle blows, it's kind of, it's all out, you know. Now it's kind of time to do the thing. So I think what I want to kick off here is, you know, you were one of the coaches that I had who you were young enough to still remember, you know, how to connect with us as players. Your career was ended by an injury, and you were still able to explain things from a player's perspective. And you're someone who I always refer to as a player's coach, which I think is a compliment, but you saw things through a lens that was a little bit fresh, and it was but removed enough to know that you weren't playing anymore. So let's talk about your playing journey. You've started the game young, I would imagine. Take us through those formative years, and then, you know, take it through Green Bay to Kentucky, and then your indoor career. And then, you know, how did that really mold who you became as a man and as a coach?
Yeah, well, man, that's a great question. It's, I mean, as you said, the game now is a lot of my identity and a lot of my experience. And so I'm from Iowa City, Iowa, which probably doesn't mean a lot to a lot of people, but what it did mean at the time when I started playing was, you know, typical, there wasn't a big, soccer wasn't very popular, wasn't very big. I was, you know, like every other kid kind of back in the day, we played a lot in the neighborhood, football during football season, basketball during basketball season, and so forth. And luckily, there was a Guatemalan family that moved into my neighborhood. And I became very close with this family, traveled to Guatemala with them and things like that. And their father had played some professional soccer in Guatemala. And that's kind of where it started. And I guess in terms of today's world or what goes on today, I didn't probably play in my first real organized game till I was 9. And that was in it's called the Iowa City Kickers, just a rec league, you know. You're with your schoolmates, practice a couple times a week and play. And since you answered or since you sent those questions, it's been interesting. I tried not to think about them, but not come with preconceived answers because I like the authenticity of, you know, on the spot answering questions. But I started to think a little bit about it, and I don't know what year it was specifically. I think I was about 12 years old and I joined whatever the first competitive or travel team, you know, that I competed for. And there was a family in Iowa City, had an older brother that was a good player, and they kind of kicked it all off and organized it. And so we traveled around a little bit, you know, went to Peoria and Rockford, some stalwart tournaments in the area, the Rockford Watermelon Tournament. And played a little and I loved it. And I was a pretty athletic kid. I was, you know, in my little town, North Liberty, which is outside of Iowa City, small town, big now, but small then, you know, was one of the better baseball players, one of the better basketball players, was just pretty athletic and it's what I consume most of my time doing. And it somehow, instinctively, I had some ability in soccer, so we go through that club thing, and I get into high school, and I don't really know, you know, I don't know what's out there in the soccer world, and my dad wrestled at the University of Iowa, so I knew, hey, there's big time athletics out there. There's big time wrestling. You know, Kinnick Stadium, but there's big time football. But I didn't have any idea with soccer. So my freshman year in high school, and I didn't know if I was good, I make our varsity team. And I had a coach named Corbin Stone that was very influential on my career. And I make varsity. And that was probably the turning point where I'm like, someone said, hey, you're good at this, you know, relatively. High school varsity soccer in Iowa at the time wasn't the strongest in the world, but I was around some good players and had some success on that team, scored some goals, played a lot. And my identity kind of shifted into being a soccer player at that point. I wrestled later that year and it was terrible. But my first match lasted 39 seconds. I think my dad missed it because he went to use the restroom before I started. And that's one regret. I wish I would have continued to wrestle because I loved it. But from then on, I pretty much focused on soccer. You know, I played at a club in Iowa City and then later transitioned to playing for a club in Des Moines that had some success at the state level and participated in regionals and things like that. You know, college-wise, you talk about people that come in your life. So I had the family that started the travel program in my city, the Waffles, thanks to them. And then Corbin Stone, my coach in high school. And then by chance, a guy moved into Iowa City named Homer Screws. And real name, he played for the Tacoma Stars with Ricky Davis, Steve Jungle. He was a big time player when the NASL, I believe it was a big league and attracted, you know, I mean, Ricky Davis was the captain of our national team and he was there wasn't any outdoor options. He was playing in this league. So he kind of taught me what it was like then to really try to perfect something and really train hard. And without him, I wouldn't have, who knows where I would have ended up in college. I mean, great guy, great player, intense guy, had all the ingredients that I needed. I mean, we used to give you an example of how he helped me translate something I could be good at into something that shaped my entire future. He'd meet me at 5 a.m. at my high school. My dad would drive me there. Somehow we'd get into the high school. We'd go in the gym. They wouldn't let us turn the lights on. So there was like an exit sign light, you know, up like 10 yards or a little sliver of the gym. And we do that like 4 or 5 times a week and just train. And he taught me the importance of training, and he kept me very level too, because I thought I was, you know, at that point in Iowa City, I was pretty good, and I thought I was pretty good. And he showed me, you don't know what you don't know, and that I had a lot of work to do. So as we went into the college, going into college, you know, at that point, obviously there's no internet. This is 1994 when I'm graduating from high school, or limited use of the internet. And how you do research and how you conduct your college search was much different then. And no one had seen me play at a tournament. I don't think I'd ever been to a tournament where there was a college coach, maybe the regional tournament my senior year, but by that time I'd already decided. And so I was relying on this guy and his contacts and what he thought my ability was. And at that time, to give you some context, one guy in my city and maybe 5 that I know of, and that's on the upper side in Iowa, had gone on to play Division I soccer. So you're talking about it was just very new. And anyway, I go through the process. I look at a couple different places, Kentucky being one of them. And that was because we had a family friend in Lexington that had a connection with the Kentucky program, Green Bay being one, I think Southwest Missouri State being one. So I go on these visits, do these things. And the coach at Green Bay happened to be, had some connection with this guy, Homer. And I ended up there, long story short. Unbelievable soccer environment there. You know, Green Bay, Wisconsin is very blue collar. The campus is very blue collar. Commuter school, which I knew nothing about. I mean, I was so naive in this whole process. I got there, they had Adidas stuff, and I loved Adidas, and I'm like, whew, I'm basing my decision off that, you know, like, oh my God, they get free Adidas gear. And so end up there, and they were good. You know, they, the year before I came, they beat Clemson at Clemson and had some other really good results. So I end up there, and I'm, this kind of goes back to what we were talking about in your marathon running. I didn't know if I was good or if I wasn't good, but I wasn't afraid of finding that out. And I don't think many people expected much, you know, a guy from Iowa and, you know, who knows, no one really knows about it. And I right away get into the team and start, and had a guy there named Quinn Ross. Dave Poggi was the head coach, great guy, created a lot of opportunities for me. An assistant coach named Quinn Ross, who, how you describe maybe our relationship a little bit, I kind of had with him. Great player, like intense dude, always willing to give you the extra time. And he really had a huge influence on me. And it was just an unbelievable environment. Most impressive as a player were there, and it wasn't with coaches. You know, like I said, it's commuter campus, underground tunnels connect classrooms, snow up to here. There's not a lot to do. So we played every day. Every single day, a group of players are getting together and playing. And it was essentially, I work at a small liberal arts school now, and the campus was, there was more students, but essentially about that size. So everything's very accessible, easy to meet up with guys. And we're out there playing. I remember there's days we'd be out in our courtyard in front of our apartment, you know, playing Bob Marley or something, playing to 2 picnic tables for like 4 hours. And intense, like where you hated. Me and my roommate, Matt Johnson, who's another huge influence on me, playing against these two guys, Kevin Brooks and Adam Bruckner. And it wasn't very friendly, you know, and there's cheating going on and people wanted to win. But unbelievably formative for me, learning how to, you know, we didn't have the resources of some of the big programs. So we did a lot on our own. We lifted weights on our own. We ran on our own. We played on our own. And those two teams, I was there my freshman and sophomore year. You know, we beat Notre Dame. We played Portland and Washington, and we tied one and beat one. I can't remember which one. That's an interesting – my first game ever, freshman, you know, like for some reason we have our names in the back of our jersey. I don't know why. And it's at Portland. Unbelievable environment. They had a guy named Clive Charles, legend in the soccer community, was their coach. Great history. Guys in the Canadian national team, really good team. It's the first day of class there, I think, and – I'm playing wide right, wide left. Anyway, like I'm up against the sideline. Sideline's here. The stands there in the student section. They're like 3 feet away from me, you know. And I got the name on my back of my jersey. I'm this scrawny little 5'9 freshman who has no idea what's about to happen. And they just harassed me the entire game. And like I said, we won or tied. I don't know if I touched the ball the entire game, but I was just so, like, I don't know, a little scared, a little jacked, a little whatever. I just ran the entire time. I mean, I ran. I don't know how much I ran, but it was a lot. And there was this guy I was defending. He coaches now, or, you know, not defending, but he was playing on my side. Darren Sawatsky, I think. I think he works in the Portland Timbers organization, or one of those. He's a coach now. He was lightning fast, lightning fit, senior, and I was just trying to survive the entire game. And I did a decent job. I mean, I didn't have any effect on the game, probably with the ball, but I ran and, you know, got some praise from my coach for running. And that year we had some good success. Like I said, beat Notre Dame, won our conference, and did a few things. So we had a good team. I really learned, I guess, hey, I want to be better at this. Got a little taste of what's out there outside of my Iowa City bubble. And it was a great experience. Well, my sophomore year, my coach left. And, you know, at the time, I'm a naive 20-whatever-year-old at the time. Don't really know. Saying I think I have a vision for what I wanted. But I'm from Iowa City, Big Ten camp, you know, Big Ten campus, kind of college town, and we don't have that. And so a couple factors like that coupled together, and I end up looking in at the University of Kentucky, and I was actually going to go to Wisconsin, Madison, and Ian Barker was the coach at the time, and he had seen me some when we played them and with some club stuff in Wisconsin, and had some interest. And that year they win the national championship. This is 1996. And once that happened, you know, he called me up. He's like, Matt, we're still interested in you, but this has kind of changed. You know, we have some national team guys interested now. And so we wouldn't have any money for you. And I couldn't afford it, you know, and Kentucky was much more affordable, and I visited there and loved it. So I ended up going to Kentucky and finishing my last two years there. So it was we played Green Bay actually and lost to them, so it was that was a tough pill to swallow. But Kentucky, I love my time there, love my teammates, love the whole school. But it was very different, you know. Like looking back, I didn't think I wanted a small school, but for my soccer career, my soccer ability, and all those things, it probably would have been the best thing, you know. So you know, at UK, you got people living 3 miles away, and there's a lot more going on, probably a lot more distractions. And you didn't have that kind of thing where every day, you know, you meet up at 3 and you're going to be in the gym playing 1v1, 2v2, 3v3. Doesn't matter. Half the reason you're just trying to pass time, but because you love to do it too. So yeah, after that, and my senior year, we had a good team at Kentucky. We lost in the conference semifinal, to Bowling Green, who had a really good team, a couple really good players. It was a good game. So that I didn't really know what I was going to do. And my former coach at Green Bay got hired, kind of a regional indoor league called the Eastern Indoor Soccer League. It was primarily in the South, Louisiana, Mississippi, Florida. Ended up getting on a team there and played with some unbelievable players. It was kind of the way this league was set up, and our team won the league. A lot of the younger guys from the whatever MISL would come here because the seasons were different, and they'd come play in this league in the summer. So I played with two brothers, the Dusoski brothers, who were big-time indoor players, a guy named Bo Brown, who's probably the best player I've ever played with, and then my roommate, again, from Green Bay, Matt Johnson, who played indoor for a long time. So got to play there for a year. Really probably the most amazing summer I've had, you know, just getting to play soccer and get paid a little bit and not have to worry about anything else, with great players. And kind of like by the second to last game of the year, a playoff game maybe, I go into keepers coming out, through balls played into me. We're both going for the ball. I plant on my right foot to try and poke it around him, put all my weight on my right foot. Guy slides in, and I shatter my tibia and my fibula. Double compound fracture. So I was pretty much done. And that was a good thing because I wasn't good enough to be a pro. And it was gave me a perfect excuse to transition to coaching and, you know, give up on the playing dream. And I had a chance to probably play in the Premier League, but I couldn't get my mom a job there, you know, so she would have picked me for sure. I know. But it was ended at 22, so relatively young, but I wouldn't change a thing about it, I don't think.
No, I think it's fitting because when I transferred from UIC and I played at Green Bay a ton, and we used to go up there 2 days early. It was a bus ride. It was a dreary bus ride because we always played them late in the season, and it was cold, colder than Chicago, which was impressive. And I think we'd go to a Perkins or a Logan Steakhouse nearby, and our coach would give us a restricted menu, and we'd play in the parking lot, and then we'd take the tunnels to play the game, and they gave us a tour, and it was like, you know, UIC is also a commuter campus, so I was like, kind of, it felt weird because it's in this giant city, but when we got to Green Bay, it was like, oh, this is a commuter campus in a town that is a city, and always good games though. And so I think we talked about this, God, many years ago, but I was like, you had played Horizon League and I was, you know, coming from there to UK. So that was interesting. I think, you know, one thing that you've mentioned, is, you know, your injury and it, again, I don't want to dwell on this, but you mentioned that was a good thing. Cause you knew that maybe the level that you aspired to be, or you didn't even know was there. You weren't really at that level. What was the defining moment or realization when you said, okay, this is a unique opportunity for me to either pack my things, leave the game behind, lock it in the closet, and then just go on and, you know, do something else in my life? Or, you know, maybe my target has shifted from playing to now being involved in the game. And can I still do this without feeling the itch and the, you know, the hindsight of wanting to try it again? What was the process there? Because I can't imagine it's easy, and I'm not saying that it is, but I do think that the traumatic injury you had may have been to your benefit in that there was a sudden shift of gears and you decided to, you know, stick with soccer just in a different capacity.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a great point. Like, it did make it easier. Like, you know, I mean, it gave me an excuse and allowed me to enable myself a little bit, but it wasn't like it was, you know, I was a 20, whatever, that was 1998. So what am I, 22? And I know everything and I think I'm better than I am. And so, you know, they started a new league immediately following when I break my leg. And like I said, it's the end of the season. I have to go back to school because I hadn't finished school. And my roommate, who's one of my best friends, Matt Johnson, he's going to drive me back. And so this is like 3 days post-surgery, and I'm cast up to my hip. He's got this old, I can't even remember that this car he had. He probably bought for $500, and it was small. And so we're leaving in the middle of the night to go back to Kentucky, and he's going to drop me off, and he's going to go back to Green Bay. And I mean, we have all our stuff, everything we own in this little Dodge Colt. That's what it was, Dodge Colt. And I'm in the back. I got a little space this big to sit in, my legs up. I've got pain pills, you know, because I'm just recovering. He's driving. No AC. I mean, those are the good old days. We're both miserable. We get to like the middle of Mississippi and his headlights go out. And there's no light. I mean, it is pitch black. We're on the side of the road. Miserable. So for a while there, you know, semi would dart by and he tried to follow him as long as I can. I'm like, we're going to die. And he's like, you're probably right. So we sleep in the car a couple of hours, drenched in sweat till it gets light, finish out the drive, whatever. I mean, not that story applies to anything we're talking about, but just back in the day, you know, it's a good story to what we're doing. But I was really close with him and this guy, Bo Brown, and a couple other guys. So our coach then gets hired for a team called the Utah Freeze, which was a new, in Salt Lake City, a new World Indoor Soccer League. And so, you know, he's like, hey, you should come out. And so this is like 10 months after my surgery and everything. And I wasn't fit. I wasn't healthy. I think I forged my trainer's note to go out there and try out. And I went out there and I was terrible. You know, I mean, I was not good. And part of that was I wasn't healthy. Part of it was I probably just wasn't good enough. But I also wasn't healed. And so then I went back to Lexington and coached a little. But the itch came one more time because these all – it was more I was going because of I was so close with these guys, you know. And they probably knew I wasn't good enough either, but we enjoyed being around each other. There was one last hurrah. In Lafayette, where we played indoor, Lafayette, Louisiana, they started a PDL team, and these guys were going to go back there in the summer because it was a great place and playing this PDL team. And they said, come play. And so I went and did that, and I actually played the majority of the season with them. And I just knew. I just, you know, I wasn't at their level. And so this is maybe a year or two after the injury, but it was – it made it easier to realize, hey, this is a great time to break away from this. And those guys all went on and played for a number of years in different leagues and are great players. But probably beneficial to me that I was able to jump into coaching right away.
And so coaching, did that take you back to your roots in Iowa then? Or did you stick around Lexington? How did that – I mean, I can imagine that you probably had a number of opportunities and – jumping into what I would probably imagine to be the youth game, which is a treacherous place for any young former player to test their to cut their teeth, so to speak. When I did, yeah. It was terribly intimidating, and I'm like, "These are kids. Why are they?" But yeah, so where'd that take you then?
Well, this is one of those examples. This happened a few times in my life where a very illogical decision turned out to be, in retrospect, a great decision. Maybe like going to Green Bay because they had Adidas, you know. And so I'm back. I know I'm kind of jumping over. I'm back in Lexington. I'm on crutches, man. I'm miserable, you know, like finishing school. I hadn't finished school. And I always had this thing. I want to coach at my high school. And then I was at UK at the time. I want to coach at Kentucky. And then who knows? So by chance, my high school job opens up, you know, and this is, I think I had a semester to finish, but this is in December. Iowa plays in the spring, but I'd have to go back and miss school. And I'm like, that's what I want to do. And then I'll come back and finish school. So I go interview, I get hired. I'm 24. I hire my best friend, Brad Stiles, who's another great coach from Iowa that we played together club. And I don't think they wanted to hire us because we're young and rightfully so. They'd look at a few other, we're probably like the third choice, you know. Go back and like I said, like I honestly think if you're, and again, it's hard to measure yourself. Just naturally, I didn't know too much to cloud me with that team. I motivated the guys somehow. You know, I was basically their age. We end up winning the state championship, and they had never done it. And I knew nothing. I knew nothing about soccer other than things from playing or how to run a session or whatever. You know, I mean, we were playing 3-5-2, some crazy thing. Probably the roles now you'd look at and people like, this is ridiculous. Well, we won. And so from there, you know, the high school thing was part-time, obviously, and I didn't teach. But in town, there was a club, and they offered me a job after that, a job full-time coach. And I hadn't finished school yet, but I'm like, I can't pass this up. I can coach all day long. That's amazing. You know, I think I was making like $22,000. I'm like, this is the greatest thing on earth. And it was. So get into club, and again, had a guy named John Cook, who's still one of my mentors today, who still runs the club. And the guy Corbin Stone, who was my high school coach, started the club. So I had those two guys to kind of say, okay, let's refine you a little bit and teach you some things. And so this is the greatest thing I ever did, in my opinion, my coaching career. Work at that club. I'm on the field 5 hours every night. That's how this club set up. Working U8 boys, U9 girls to U18 boys and girls. 3-4 sessions a night. You don't know how many kids are going to show up for sure. I mean, I just thrown into the fire and coaching all weekend. Loved every minute. But it's like, you know, learning from the ground up. I knew nothing about what was age appropriate. I knew nothing about different gender. I knew nothing about, you know, player development philosophies, any of those things. And just one, being around great people, but two, whatever you want to call it, the 10,000 hour rule, maybe. Man, I learned so much in those years, how to be adaptive, how to connect with kids, how to have a plan, and you plan for 10 kids and 3 show up and you got to make a change. And that stuff has helped me more in my career than anything, you know. Then from there, so I was there 3 or 4 years, and I was kind of dating this girl in Lexington off and on, and I still hadn't finished, you know. So how I ended up actually back in Lexington was move back to finish school, be with her, volunteered with the team. And then by chance, the job opened up there. And when Keeney left, you know, it was pretty unexpected. He decided to move on. And next thing you know, I'm an assistant coach there and for 10 years. So I was very lucky in so many different ways. But yeah, the perfect path, like starting with 8-year-olds and just learning from the bottom up, which is the way I'd like to learn a lot of things now. But, you know, we like to skip ahead. And so we got to kind of go back and reverse engineer things sometimes. But I didn't have to in this because I lucked out and ended up in the right place at the right time. Not because I made some savvy choice just by chance, which is a big part of it, you know, luck.
Oh, I think it's, you know, one of the questions that I was going to pose to you, but you've kind of navigated is, you know, there's this crossover between coaching and life. And, you know, if you would ask me when I left Kentucky, where would I be in the next 5-10 years? It looks radically different on paper than how it panned out. And it didn't pan out poorly, you know, but it was one of those things where, you know, you in life and in coaching and especially playing, but there's the game plan and then there's the actual reality of what happens. And I think I'm always intrigued to see where people allow themselves to not drift, but let the sails take them in a direction where there's this crossover between, you know, the game and life itself. And, you know, if people are listening to this podcast, they're obviously immersed in the game. There is probably a lifestyle or a big passion of theirs. One thing that I found is coaches that I speak to that are still doing it at a variety of different levels, they have this way, and we talked about this with social media a little bit, of detaching from some of the immersion aspects of coaching. And I think the modern coach has to implement things that are radically different than coaches that maybe coached you or even myself. And I'm looking at, you know, the game today, and it is, although the same, it is a drastically different landscape. How do you find yourself continually evolving, you know, continually leading from the front, or giving yourself an opportunity to learn, whether it's, you know, leveraging social media, whether it's leveraging, you know, reading or some meditation or some type of thing where you're not necessarily getting a soccer lesson out of it, but you're able to apply an experience to, you know, the next coaching session, or having your players in this, these unforeseen times, you know, say, hey, you guys are on your own, or we're not having a season, but there's still work to do. How do you implement, you know, things that you've learned along the way? Because your journey is anything but conventional. And I think players now need some of that. They need some of that unpredictability, because I think so much of our game is structured and scripted and defined for us. And when we get into it, it's nothing like that at all.
Yeah, well, a couple of things there. So you're talking about your game plan, you know, and this is very valid. Like, we, that question, they love to ask that on interviews. Like, what's your 5-year plan? Like, if you can answer that, man, you are so, you are a genius. I mean, and it's funny in those things, those interviews. I mean, they want you to validate what they know, not show what you know, you know? And so, like, you're talking about writing that plan. This is something I thought we'd probably talk about. It's like you get your soccer magnet board out, right? You design your tactics. Everything works. Oh, yeah, this guy's going to rotate here. You're like, oh, my God, this is brilliant. This is going to be the greatest way to build out of the back or press or whatever. Then you get on the field, and in 2 seconds, you're like, it's so complex and random that you, it's great. You can have all these magnets, and you can talk yourself through it. And as soon as you play the ball, like something – I don't want to say random. I learned in this podcast, random is just, what is it? The acknowledgement of our, what we can't understand, you know, so we call it randomness, but, something happens and it's just blown out of the water, right? Like, this is the dumbest idea I've ever had. I think a skill as a coach is to realize that and not try and stick to it, but like, let's change. And sometimes the players will be like, this is stupid. And you're like, you're right. Let's change this right now. And you didn't plan for this. So a huge part of coaching is, a great question is, what don't I know? You know, we all like to say what we do know. And I definitely know more, don't know more than I know. So there's an abundance of information out there that I'm trying to find. But when you talk about learning now and adapting, I'd say 90% of my learning now is non-soccer related. Yeah. Reading, podcasts, listening to people, conversations with my buddy. Like, I drive an hour to work. I work at a Division III school now called Hanover College, which is long story in itself, but unbelievable experience. And so I have an hour drive. I learn more in that hour drive back and home probably than I did in college. So what are you learning about in this time of, you know, the times have changed, but people haven't, if that makes sense. And I'm learning how to be a better listener. I'm learning how to communicate better. I'm reading a book right now. There's a guy in Iowa that's one of my best friends and Hall of Fame girls softball coach. I know you had mentioned sports psychology. He's a genius when it comes to this stuff. And he gave me this book. It's called, it's on motivational interviewing. I don't know if you've heard of that at all. MI. And just how to, it's very, very interesting on how to not be a fixer all the time. It's similar to guided discovery, which is a big methodology in U.S. soccer, but a little bit different. And just so how to internally get John Townsend to realize what you want him to realize, but you're not telling him to do it. He's figuring out why himself. And that's probably a really bad recap. The authors might yell at me for that, but I'm only a couple, 40 pages in. But I'm learning in domains outside of soccer, and it's made me so much better. It's kind of like, you know, like I use these examples with my team or other coaches I'm talking to a lot. There's a quote about, you know, when the light bulb was invented, it was a big innovation, and that could only happen by not trying to improve the candle. You know, if you keep trying to improve the candle, you don't get the light bulb. Or there's a guy, Dick Fosbury, who who was, I think, Olympic high jump champion. He's the guy that changed. They used to jump over feet first, you know? And he's the guy that actually changed. They call it the Fosbury flop, to jumping over backwards. And so you got to be – you can't look at a problem, in my opinion, the same as everybody else. And you got to find different ways to communicate them and different ways to tackle different things, or else you really limit yourself. So one, learning about how to listen, how to communicate with guys, figuring out their needs, learning about myself. And then I've made a ton of mistakes, and I've learned more from those than anything, you know, and try to pass that on to the player. So in this unprecedented time, I could try and sound really smart and tell you, John, this is what we do in this pandemic. I'm learning day by day, man, yeah. Day by day. And then, you know, I like to say in this game or in life, there's very few absolutes. So you got to be flexible and your thinking, and willing to change and willing to adapt and do things that maybe you thought were really not very smart before, but maybe make sense, and have that humility to make that change.
Yeah, there's this reality that occurred to me about a month into this whole thing, and then each state has handled it differently. Each country's handled it differently, and I emailed my boss and said, "Hey, I need to come get my stuff. I'm going to be taking 2 days off." And she's like, "No, you're going to be taking 2 weeks." And I was like thinking the worst, like 2 weeks, what? She's like, "No. There's this order coming in where we can't be in the office." I'm thinking, okay, great, 2 weeks at home, no commute. And like you, I turned my commute into a curriculum. I was listening to podcasts and, you know, learning foreign languages. And I mean, I had a long commute, and this, what am I going to do? And I thought time at home is going to give me so much opportunity to just learn and do so much. And then for the first month, I didn't do anything. I couldn't write. I was just completely frozen in this weird new reality. And then people are like, "Well, you're not writing any more articles. You're not doing any more podcasts." And it was the first time when I realized there's all this artillery fire going off in my head, and I needed to stop. And it wasn't like anything was wrong. I just was trying to figure out what silence was, and how stillness was also something that I was trying to navigate. And what was amazing to see is how players and coaches that I knew were handling it themselves, because when I was younger, if you would have said, you don't have to go to school, you can't go to school, and you can't go to soccer, so you can go to the park and, you know, just do your homework online, I would have probably been over the moon to see, like, oh my, I have all day to play, and all my friends are out of school as well. And then I would drive by the local fields and there'd be nobody there. And I was like, wow, everyone is frozen. And it was kind of like to your point where I just learned how to listen. I learned how to just detach a little bit. And that one of the things that, you know, drew me to talk to you was your, and it sounds silly, but your Instagram stories were highly motivating to me, because you weren't doing anything soccer related. You were riding your bike, taking your dogs for a walk, watching the deer, you know, maybe it's just sharing some philosophy. And I think that was such a refreshing take on, here's a guy who coaches, but this does not define who he is. And his players are probably watching this as well, and they're probably navigating their own way. And I thought that was a really unique thing. So I know we talked about it a little bit before, but I think that overcoming the adversity of where we're at, but also learning more about yourself, is an incredible skill.
Yeah, and I'll be honest, John, like sometimes on my Instagram story, I'm trying to test my own vulnerability, you know? And it's funny, you post some stoic things or some maybe uplifting things, and everyone's like, "Are you okay?" And I'm like, "I'm great." And I'm just trying to pass this message on. But I try to learn from everyone. I knew I'd learn talking to you today. I mean, to give you, like, right now, talk about meditation. I'm really big into that stuff. I'm trying to do a 60 minutes a day meditation thing. Naval Ravikant, I think that's how you say it. You've probably heard of. It's kind of like a modern thinker, I guess. And I love it. You know, and I think we need to be the best you can be in anything, you need to acknowledge what you don't know. And here's an example. Like a couple years ago here at Hanover, we're playing a team, very good team, in Ohio. We get smashed 7-2. We're playing three at the back at the time. Maybe not for good reasons, maybe because I was just kind of enamored with it. And they really exposed that. So the next day we play a game against Ohio Wesleyan, who's one of the top D3 programs in the country, you know, and we're reeling, man. We are reeling. And that night in the hotel, we're like, we got to make some changes. So kind of like the way our personnel was. Anyway, we come up, we're going to play a 4-4-2 diamond. I've never done this. As coaches, we think we got to have all the answers. I think we got to have some, but we've got to know what answers we don't have. We had no answers. I didn't know how to play this system. We had never done it. So we're kind of learning as we go. And it ends up we've been playing that way for 2 years, kind of modified it and figured things out as we went the way we wanted.
So at this point, we actually had a technical difficulty and my computer. At this point in our conversation, my computer actually crashed or I lost network connectivity. We were talking about meditation and how Matt was experimenting with a new playing style, a new system, and drawing inspiration from outside influences. We pick up the conversation with how meditation isn't conventional. It is a part of life. It is a part of playing. It is a part of coaching and instructing, and it's a part of relationships. And I was saying that, you know, I found meditation in my later life to be something that's not just traditional. You don't have to have a perfect setting with incense burning and candles and a quiet room. Sometimes it's on a run. Sometimes it's mowing your grass. Sometimes it's driving your vehicle. Sometimes it's just sitting in silence or sitting with noise all around you and trying to have a cacophony of silence. And so Matt, being smooth as ever, is able to take up this conversation and really take it away. So please enjoy this next part of the recording. It's very valuable. Thanks.
Your day-to-day, because I think it's an important element in personal development for me, but also I think it comes in many forms. I think some people believe it is this formal sit down in a quiet room with incense burning and the perfect setting, but I was mentioning to you how some of my best thoughts come when I'm actually not thinking about anything. It's just I'm running or cycling or walking my dogs. And I think that that's it's also something that I've come to realize is much different than I thought it was supposed to be like. So what do you do with this 60 minutes a day for 60 days? I think that was the practice you were describing.
I don't know. I mean, that's one of the beauties of meditation, I think, is why I think it's important is I've done it minimally in the past. I'm no expert. I mean, used apps on my phone, but I've been pretty consistent. And it, you know, people say, what are the benefits? I don't know. I mean, they're immeasurable, but I think you feel a little more clarity in what you're doing. I'm a pretty impulsive guy to a fault. It gets me in trouble a lot of times, whether it be coaching or anything else. And I think it sometimes gives me a little bit of pause and moment to maybe delay or hopefully stop doing something really stupid. And it's just, you know, interested in finding different ways to invest in myself. So this thing is 60 days, 60 minutes. This guy named Naval Ravikant talks about it all the time. And part of it is just, hey, I'm always trying to do things where you have to commit to something for a certain amount of time because I think that's a skill, you know? So I'm trying it. The way I do it, I have a sauna that I just got. So I sit in the sauna when I wake up for an hour, and it's not that hot. It's infrared, and just kind of sweat and just whatever happens, happens, you know?
Yeah.
But like you said, to me, running is very meditative. Biking, you know, where it's just a real, you're not really focused on, and walking, because you don't really have to focus on any skill to do it. It's pretty automatic, and you just get a pretty clear, some clear thoughts, you know?
Yeah. And do you find your players are especially at Hanover, they're in this setting now where they, I imagine you don't know the foreseeable future, even if you have a spring season planned or whatnot. But, you know, we're in an age where digital technologies, this device is an extension of our bodies in so many ways. Do you find that some of what they are going to experience or should be refining is that detachment aspect of going for a walk, going for a run without your headphones, or go play, on your own. And don't have a plan per se, but just spend 60 minutes, you know, develop that relationship with the game or the ball or what have you. And, you know, don't report back to me, but just do that for your own betterment. Have you observed from afar? Have you managed that at all? Or, you know, I guess my larger question is going to be, what is coaching like in this environment? But I'm trying to, you know, ease into that because that's a completely loaded question.
Yeah, well, I think luckily a huge cornerstone of my philosophy, as we talked about before with the guy Homer Screws, and is training on your own, right? And so that's something I've really tried to impress upon all my athletes, is playing on your own, training on your own, being creative. You know, you might, when I was young, I used to go, and I hate this, you know, I'm not saying this because I turned into some great players, but I know this helped me. I would go dribble a soccer ball around this golf course behind my house, you know, for 2-3 mile dribble in between trees. And was it functional? I don't know, but it was effective for me. It helped me. It made me feel like I was doing something. I felt it made me better. So I think it made me better. So that's been a huge cornerstone of what we do here, is I'm all about guys. And even when we're training and I'm leading it, we do a lot of playing, you know. And D3, honestly, I've learned this. Like when I first got here to Hanover coming from Kentucky, I mean, we controlled everything you did all day, every day. John, you do this, 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 told you what to do. Mm. What to do and how to do it. And maybe you don't learn then how to think for yourself, right? Or why you're doing something. So when I got here at Hanover, one, it's just me. In the off season, I have limited time with the players, very limited. And I'm like, this is going to be a nightmare. And then they're like, and they're all in fraternities. I'm like, oh, this is the worst thing ever. Well, turns out, you know, the voluntary workouts feed right into that philosophy of once you take ownership or something, that's when you excel. And so the guys are showing up because they think showing up helps them achieve something they want to achieve. And so there's a real importance to it. So they show up on their own and they play on. It's been one of the building blocks, one of the most important things, I think. And I never, this is a big thing, I never tell guys, you have to be at this workout. Show up if you want. If you want to get better, show up. And we get a really good turnout because guys know that this step and this step and this step lead them closer to something they want. And so that's been really important. And part of it is just because the D3 model, I think that's something that the D1 model probably could learn from, you know, like is some of that self, whatever, free play you want to call it, or you're going to do, like in the classroom, for example, you know, recruits always come in and they say, do you do study tables? And I say, no, why not? Because me telling you to go get good grades doesn't accomplish anything. I've been a part of it as a student. Until you take ownership that you want to do well in school, you're not going to do well in school. And there's nothing that I can go make you sit in a room. And you know what guys do? They find out how to waste that time in the room. And they're defiant about it. You know that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, it's you have to figure out I'm doing this for myself. So luckily here, they have some type of, and that's kind of perpetuated. It's a little bit through our culture is, guys know they have to get together and do things on their own without me involved, and that's going to help them. So I don't even know if I answered the question. I can't remember what the question was.
Well, the question is really about, you know, how are you coaching in these in a time where your former coaches didn't have this experience, you didn't have this experience as a player. You have a group of young men who, if left to their own devices, as we know, will find something to do and fill that void. And again, it's not about not trusting players or the modern player struggles with this environment. In many ways, they're probably more adaptable than we are. But I've been curious to see one of the elements that I've seen in this year is some coaches have really evolved and people have really evolved. Coworkers have really evolved in this, and some have almost been fearful of the change that is pressed upon us. I think there's this weird phenomenon that I'm experiencing with people that I know that the change is coming. It is here, and they are resistant to this. And they keep saying, I want to go back to normal. And I keep thinking, I think this is normal. I think this is the new reality. Now, take all the complexity out of the politics of it all. I just think I've been very intrigued to see how, at the level that you're coaching, how these days, these months that, you know, are going to lead into a year have helped level set or helped you reevaluate your approach as a coach. I think that's an incredible opportunity for people to really take stock of what they're doing.
Yeah, no, well, one thing we were talking about too before was the access these guys have to, you know, their phone all the time. And it's not only that, a tough thing now, it's hard to be by ourselves. I'm learning a lot of people really struggle to be by themselves. And with our phones, with what we can have almost whatever we want, whenever we want it, at any time, you know, like little things I think about. Spotify, I can go listen to whatever song I want, right? Simple thing. But back in the day, I don't know if you remember, you had to wait in the radio for that song to come on. And when it came on, you were jacked. And you sort of lose that intrigue and curiosity or ability to wait for something good to happen. Mm. Like, it's okay, it's not on. Now it's like, we got to have it right now. Mm. I think what I've learned is, or it's been hard to learn is, you know, like you said, hey, this time's been pretty okay. We're by ourselves, but we're probably people that don't need a lot of social stimulation, maybe because of our age or whatever. And I know our guys have really struggled with that. I mean, young people are social people and need to be out around, like just around that energy. Mm-hmm. And I know once kind of in Kentucky, I do a lot of youth coaching in Kentucky too. In the summer when school was closed down, once the restrictions got lifted and we were able to get out and train, man, guys were, what an outlet they needed. And it was interesting here when this whole thing happened in March at Hanover. It's the time of year where spring break's going on and everyone's like, you know, this place sucks. And it happens at every school, like, I need out, blah, blah, blah. And it ended and everybody's in tears, like, we don't want to leave. So it put in perspective, I think, for a lot of people, like, okay, well, this is something that's really important to me more than I thought. But how am I dealing with it? I think a lot of it is it's different with every athlete, just like everything else, because their needs are different. But you're trying to open up different lines of communication. I mean, I'll tell you, the toughest part has been for our freshmen. I feel like I don't know them, you know, because we barely trained this year. We had like 6 weeks to train. We're not on the road together. We're not competing together, which brings teams together. One of the biggest things, and people probably laugh at this, most important things, and this helped us be successful here at Hanover, and it's funny, usually none of these things have to do with soccer. I go eat lunch with the guys in the cafeteria pretty much every day. And they make fun of me. I make fun of them. We banter like normal human beings. And you really get to know people and open that door for them to approach you maybe when they need to approach. You just build some trust as a human being. And I'm not supposed to go eat in the cafeteria. And obviously the dynamics of the cafeteria have changed totally. So I feel like I don't know them very well. And our students here, unbelievable job of managing this thing and being diligent and following rules. But our seniors we can't be in big groups, so they can't. It's harder to get them involved with the younger players, if that makes sense. So I feel like we're on the verge of having a big gap between this culture we've developed and how it's perpetuated itself and these guys figuring out how do we act, what do we do, what's important, what do we value. So like you said, you brought the phone up earlier. Some of it has been, it's been a huge help in finding different mediums to get the information out, you know, and I mean, I'm not supposed to have guys in my office for a meeting. So there's been a lot of challenges, but I think it's just been, again, going back to this and listening, a lot of listening to what each guy needs and then helping them. Telling them I don't have the answers. I've never been in a pandemic, but let's see if we can figure something out together and listen to each other and go from there. So,
yeah, one of the things that I had presented to you as a question is I use this phrase, and I don't know who. I think it was a strength conditioning coach when I was in high school, and in my experience, my high school is a wrestling mill and turning out state champs every year, and football was the driver as well. But I took a strength conditioning class with all those athletes as a soccer player, and it was one of the best things I could have done because we had a coach there who used to write on this board, live the code, and it was and it applied to the wrestling team, obviously. But I asked him what it meant, and he said, well, I can't tell you what it means if you're not on the wrestling team, but I'll tell you this, you're doing the right things. Just, you know, don't worry about what it means. Just keep doing what you're doing. And that carried me through my own journey in the game, and especially even at UK, because, you know, there's times when you will feel quite alone. Even back when we were playing, there was no pandemic. There was an open campus. It was, you know, business as usual. And I think the journey for a player or even, you know, a young coach is you could have everyone around you and still not have a clue what's going on and not know what's coming. And I think for me, it was learning about abiding by a set of principles that were good for me as a person, but also helped me succeed in other arenas. There's a thing that I had presented to you, though, about especially in these times when you can't be with the players, which is it's not what you say, but what they hear. Have you seen or heard that phrase, and how have you seen that manifested in your own coaching and relationships with these players, especially the young ones, because you know they're encountering a world where they thought they'd be part of a group and a campus, and now it's completely different.
Yeah, I've heard that, and I think it's one unbelievably true. I mean, and we all experience this in many parts of our lives, but sometimes we devalue it and we're trying to give it to somebody else, and not only what they hear, but how they perceive it, how you say it maybe can be wrong. I mean, and that's part of the reading this book on motivational interviewing, you know, like you're trying to me, communication and connection are the two most important things in coaching. And you're always trying to refine those things. And you might, it can be very simple, John. I think sometimes we try to overcomplicate things. I mean, I remember vividly in my mind, because it didn't happen that often, someone come up to me and saying, good job, good job. That's all I needed, you know? And, but yeah, I mean, I think that's why if you have one of the things about like eating lunch with guys and having a relationship where they're comfortable talking to you, then you know more what they're hearing from what, does that make sense?
Like, yeah.
And so you can guide that and make sure that there's less discrepancy or misinterpretation of what, you know, what you said and how you think it was going to come off one way, and it might come off the total opposite. So I'm really, and that's a slippery slope, because in your head you're trying to manage that, you know, but there's always, well, he could interpret this way, he could interpret this way. I mean, it's a difficult thing to deal with. So I try to be very cognizant of what I say to players and how I say it to them and when I say it to them. But my biggest weakness as a human being and as a coach is, as I said before, impulsive. And when I'm emotional, I make terrible decisions. And so I've got to manage all those things as well. And, you know, you can say one thing to one person, like I'll have relationships with guys, unbelievable relationships for 4 years, and you help build them, you have very close relationships, you experience a lot together, and randomly and something will come up and you're like, what do you remember most? And they'll remember one day when you said like something that you thought was totally nondescript, and that's dominated their thoughts for 4 years. Maybe something really silly like, hey, like you can't drive a ball, or you know, something that you wouldn't think about, like why did you, like. So yeah, you have to be careful. I mean, it's difficult, and I don't. You'll never not make those mistakes, in my opinion. You could just try to minimize them.
Sure. Now, so I think my last question, which is probably one of the more loaded ones, is talk about how your players have changed and how the environment has shifted from all the different coaching experiences you've had. You mentioned, you know, UK, for example, everything is laid out, scripted, what you eat, when you sleep, go to cats, go to all these things. And, you know, you've had to make, I guess I'll call them micro adjustments from a macro view. It's, you're a completely different coach now, I would imagine. You're a completely different human being, which is a good thing. You know, you spend 10 years in one place, and now you've been going on 9-10 years at Hanover. What would you say is the difference between being in an environment where you are part of the machine, so to speak, and then now you're the architect of that environment? Maybe you are the person who is at the control panel, but you're not necessarily joysticking everything. You're letting things be more open and free. Because when you mentioned players not going to workouts, like, alarm bells just rang in my head, like, what? But again, it's a completely different culture, different time, and a different methodology. How is that really going from this, you know, you grew up in an environment where, you know, you played, you know, big Division I schools, and then everything is hyper control, and now it's, you know, a different type of control. How would you say you've dealt with that, and how do you continue to, you know, I keep using the word evolve, but improve year after year?
Yeah. Well, I think it comes down to one thing, to simplify it as much as possible, which is, I think, something that's important. And I've learned this here, like you said, it's totally different, but it comes down to being yourself. I think there's a lot of times in my coaching career where I've struggled, and it's when I've tried to be somebody else. And you can't fake that. And so you have to be yourself, and that you can't really explain that, right? That's a pretty complex thing, but it has to be, you have to be instinctual, and you have to say what you think, and you have to, and you have to learn, and you have to evaluate yourself. This isn't working. That's a hard thing to do, right? Look yourself in the mirror and say, that's bad. I know you, it's going to hurt your ego, but you need to fix this. So, you know, I feel like a little bit at Kentucky, I got a little bit away from who I am. And that's probably natural when you're working for other people, right? Like, you become a little bit of, you kind of figure out, if you're a smart guy, what they like and what they want, and you assimilate to that a little bit. So, you know, getting here to Hanover, it was a lot of let's learn as we lay the tracks down and relearn. Because as I told you before, I feel like one of my best coaching jobs, and not that I sit around thinking, what's your best coaching job, but was when I was 24, knew nothing, was a high school guy. And why was it best? Because my relationships with them were so strong. You know, and you talked about sports psychology and the questions. To me, that is the biggest, most important thing in coaching. And what's a good way to explain? I explain it like this to people. There was a week where I was a very good player, right? Maybe top of, let's take the team at Kentucky. Maybe in the top 1 to 3 players on that team. It's a good team, good players. Same at Green Bay. And then the following week, I couldn't walk and chew gum because something had gone wrong there. And so my skill set did not change, right? I still had the same skills. So when we're talking about how do we make an impact in coaching, well, technically, can you improve players? Obviously, yes. Tactically, yes. But you're talking probably small percentages there, especially in a college season or a club season, when mentally, if you won, don't get in the way. Don't ruin something. I think the biggest, people talk about player development all the time. What's the biggest key to player development? Don't stop their development. That's number one.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of times players develop on their own, and we like to take credit for it, but don't stop it. And then let them be themselves. And we talk about this a lot here at Hanover. One of our rules is mistakes are okay, but you cannot make a mistake because you're scared to make a mistake or you're trying not to make a mistake. And then your language and training, it's important that all the players are upholding that, right? Because I can make a mistake and then one guy says something to me and then I'm in the tank. But we're all trust each other enough to know that, hey, we're free here. Mm. When you play unafraid and free, that's when you're at your best. And you know, a lot of my philosophy as a coach, we talked about, where do you learn now? Dan Gable is who my dad wrestled for at Iowa. My dad's 65 has a picture of Dan Gable in his man cave. And Dan Gable was Olympic champ, you know, won 22 straight Big Ten titles, 15 NCAA titles. That's where I grew up, in that wrestling room. My dad would take me down there watching this man, and he'd come talk to me, and everything's so simple when he talks. And he was the best because obviously got so much out of people, but he let them be themselves. Mm-hmm. And so I've always tried to come back to that when I'm struggling as a coach. You know, I struggle now. Maybe it's something like yelling at the referees. I'm terrible at that. And what is that? That is the manifestation of my self-consciousness or frustration or all the above. And so I got to confront that. And I do try to confront those things. It doesn't always end up, you go from not doing it well to it's fixed right away, right? You take baby steps that people don't see, but trying to be myself every day, not trying to, you know, run a certain system like John Towns would run it, maybe take some things from him, but this is how I want it to look. And I think sometimes in coaching courses, sometimes we turn people off a little bit to maybe some innovation, because when I first started them, they talked in absolutes. This happens, you do this. And the game is way too dynamic for that, you know, and I think they've evolved some, but it's a lot of things, a lot of innovation in the game. Well, first, Jurgen Klopp, the first thing that everyone talks about with Jurgen Klopp, I know you're a big Liverpool fan and I'm not, but I love him, is he's a man's players coach. You mentioned it earlier. Like, that's number one. That probably allows him to do the things they do.
Mm-hmm.
Play at that breakneck pace. And so the person is at the front of everything, man managing them, letting them be themselves, right? Like, I don't want them to be like me. Hopefully they have way more to offer. If a player only gets as good as what I know, I've probably limited them. I want them to be more than that. And so helping people being comfortable being themselves as well, as I'm trying to do the same thing. So I know I went a ton of tangents there, but like, it's funny in coaching, you know, everyone wants to judge everybody else. And, you know, people say, what's your style and blah, blah, blah. And it's got to be binary. A's right, B's wrong. A lot of these adaptations in coaching, like the way Pep started playing at Barcelona, everyone said, you can't do that. That's radical. You can't roll the ball out to your center back right away when he's getting. Well, then it took over the world, right? Then Klopp comes to Liverpool and breakneck and running. You can't do that. Everybody's going to get hurt. And then everybody wants to do it after they, you know, after a little while. So you have to be brave to do things, in my opinion, as a head coach, that people on Twitter might say, that's dumb. That doesn't make – because anyone can always find a way to – what they call them, deficit detectives, right?
Mm-hmm.
They can always find a weakness. They can always find something to say won't work, or – but you know within your team what will work for you. And so I've tried to be true to my instincts, be true to myself as I've evolved in this coach – in this head coaching role at Hanover. And I learn every day, every minute of every day. You know, like I learned, this is a great story. So I think we got cut off. I was saying this. We started to play a 4-4-2 diamond, which is kind of unorthodox. I knew nothing about. I didn't know how to coach it. I'm like, well, let's figure it out, because we're kind of at a critical desperation moment. We just lost 7-2. We had 12 hours to implement a new system. I thought it fit. Let's let it fly. Well, we let it fly. We learned how to figure it out. Like, I learned how I wanted to coach it from there. I didn't know. And I told the guys, I don't know, guys. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if this will work. And I think they valued that. But so we've played that way for 2 years, and we've evolved every single year. Every day you figure out new nuance to make it better, hopefully. And so I'm helping with an 07 team at Javelin right now, U14, since we don't have a college season. It's been awesome. And we play, you might be familiar with this team, St. Louis FC 07s. They're playing a 4-4-2 diamond. I don't know the coach. It was a clinic. I took like 15 things. I'm like, this guy's doing it way better than I'm doing it. I need to add this. I need to implement this. And I love the way they do that. So I think you can learn, you know, maybe if I thought I had all the answers, I'd go into that game being like, why do you got that? My way's better. But you can learn from any, in any platform, from anyone, from any person. And I took so much from that day, if you're willing and open-minded and humble. But unfortunately, in the coaching world, there's not much sharing or interaction of ideas in a conversation type way, because everyone's so territorial and protective and maybe don't want to be realized, like, there's a better way than I'm doing it. You know? And I'm every day trying to find a better way than I'm doing it. I want to do it better tomorrow.
Yeah, there's a lot of fiefdoms. And, you know, one of the things when I was in coaching in the development academy was we had basically a player development plan, and it was very, very, very intricate, and it was for my eyes only. And I said, well, wouldn't it be nice to, you know, put other people's thoughts into this, because I clearly don't know everything, and everyone here doesn't know everything. If we did, we wouldn't be here. And it was, you know, again, not a knock on anyone I was with, but it was, this is great information, but I think, you know, this isn't, but people think it's a secret. It's not a secret. And I think sometimes people try to assign ownership to things that they don't own. And I think playing philosophies and development paths and strategies are some of those things. But it's interesting, because I look at when I learn something new or I develop, you know, a new skill, it could be in anything. First thing I want to do is share it. First thing I want to do is display it. And I, again, in this time since March, I have actually reeled back a bit, because there are so many, what you call it, deficit detectors or whatnot, or there's so many people tell you what you can't do or how not to do it. It's like that scene in Apollo 13. Like, I know how it doesn't work. Tell me how it does, when they're trying to, you know, it's, and I think so much of the coaching journey is, you know, being humble and allowing yourself to be humble, but also to, you know, continue that idea of, you know, it's a cliche, but being a lifelong learner. I think too many people assume they've arrived. And I think that's a very dangerous place to be as a coach and as a player as well, I think.
As a human.
Yes. Yeah, it's a very dangerous place to be. And that is not solid ground. I think that's no man's land is what they call it. And, you know, in any environment I've ever been in professionally or, you know, through the sport, the people with the most confidence are generally the people who know the least. And I don't mean that to be, you know, completely absolute, but it's, so I'm always wary of the person who is, you know, the first to snap at something or tell you it's wrong. And I think so much of what we transfer to players, and my generation was a bit different, but so much of what we experienced was playing not to make mistakes, playing within a rigid system. And again, that was what we knew back then. But once you get out into the world, there is no coach per se. There is no playbook, and it is trial and error. It is failure, 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 failure. And from those failures, you learn so much. And I was, you know, recently reading an excerpt from the book on Jurgen Klopp. What makes him so magnetic is people want to run through a wall for him is not because of his, you know, his demeanor on the sideline. It's the way he's with his arm around your shoulder. He gets you to buy in a way that, you know, for player A to player B, it's different. And I think you hit that on the head with, you know, the diversity of personalities that you'll encounter. Yeah, I think that that's one of the more unique things about coaching that I've learned, is the players that I'm coaching are not like the players that I played with. And that's that was a very humbling thing, is the game is in many ways not different, but it's completely different. And so, yeah.
And I think, you know, like, I'm not trying to make, I think this is a problem with education now too. Like, I'm not trying to make people me. I'm trying to make them better than me.
Sure.
You know, and so if I'm just telling them what I know and not trying to find other ways to learn or listening to their perspective, you're probably really limiting them. And it's funny, you hit some things that I think about all the time and I hear all the time. In technique and tactics and soccer in general, there is no destination. There's none. It's too complex. You know, Cristiano Ronaldo has not reached his technical potential, I'm guessing. There's more in there. Yeah. And maybe those are finite differences, but he can always – that's the great thing about our game, is it's like the video game that never ends, right? Like, you get bored with one, you move on. This one never ends, because you can – martial arts is probably like this. You can always find more to get better at, or to there's always more room for growth. And that goes back to, it's funny, like style of play, or part of that comes from my personality. My style of play was born from Iowa wrestling. They're aggressive, in your face, like high pressure fitness. and Rick Pitino basketball. Like, and why? Because I loved watching them. And people say, what's your style? I hope you walk up to one of my teams watching them play and be like, they're fun to watch. And so within that, maybe that's they pass 1,000 times. Maybe that's they – we smash it forward. I don't really care. Like, I want our team to – if the best to be smart, creative, adaptive, make good decisions – if the best decision is smash it and go run in and score, let's do it. If it's to pass a bunch, let's go do that. But let's have the understanding of the game and of each other to find that solution and be solution seekers, because those are good players, you know, that can always find the solution, and it's going to be different every single game probably. And so how do you do that in development? I don't know. But I think you give the players, the more they're themselves and comfortable with who they are, not trying to be someone you want them to be, they're going to find a lot of those solutions. You know, I mean, how many times in a game, this happens to me every game, you say, you're about to say, don't do that, and then they score. And you're like, okay, my bad. I
didn't.
Yeah. You know, like, you're in the middle of saying that, and they have a better solution than you, maybe. And so I'm not demeaning the role of a coach, but maybe our job is let John Townsend be the best version of John Townsend. And I'm always searching. I know you asked in your thing, how do you show to your players that you're trying to learn? Well, I'm always trying to find my outer limits too. You find the best version of John Townsend, you be yourself, and then, hey, I can help guide you along the way with maybe you need a little just like habits, you know, training habits and commitment level, and maybe you have a little more effort in there or whatever it may be, not trying to overhaul you. And you said it too, like, instead of saying this is what's wrong with John Townsend, because anyone can watch me play and find my deficits right away, right? But can you be the guy that finds the magic in John Townsend and brings it out? This is what we need you for, because only John Townsend can do this. And we need that. We need Barry Rice to be Barry Rice. We need Jason Griffiths to be Jason Griffiths. And we need John Townsend to be John Townsend. And the moment any of you guys try to be one or the other, you're going to limit yourself, if that makes sense. And those are the teams where it's like a stew, right? Where all these different ingredients and you have a great stew, instead of having the same ingredients, probably not going to be that good.
Yeah, no, it's I think one of my – I say this almost every podcast, but one of my coaching mentors is Terry Mickler. And he said this to me when I was coaching under him. He said, you're going to learn very quickly or you're not, but telling you we live in a microwave society when it should be a crock pot. You have ingredients that go in. Some will come to the surface right away. Some will take a while to, you know, to be ready. But if you pop everything in and you push some buttons and you think that that's just going to create – you know, that gourmet thing, you're wrong. And I think he said, I've been wrong for 45 years, but he said, I do get it right occasionally. And, you know, one of the more sobering things about that reality is I don't think that methodology is really going to change with people, but it's up to coaches, I think, to change what they can. And I think that's the expectation is always going to be rapid change, rapid, you know, binary, you know, if this doesn't work, it must be wrong. Well, maybe it just needs to be tweaked. Maybe it's not something that needs to be blown up. And,
or maybe it takes time.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, I think that's one of the more you're involved in it and the longer you're involved in it, the more you learn that lesson. And, I want to be respectful of your time. Matt, where can people, if they do want to follow you on social media or they want to follow you when your season kicks off, where can they find you on these outlets?
Hopefully they can't, but no, I'm not. No, I don't even know my names or handles, but before we get there, I just want to say one thing kind of related to what you said.
Sure.
It's a great thing. I had a buddy go for a job, and this guy is very qualified, and he said, you know, he was like a strength and conditioning coach, and the guy said, okay, well, what do you do? And he goes, well, here's my plan, and A, B, C, D, E, F, and G, they're all doing this. And the guy goes, well, okay, if they're all doing it, why would we do it? Because we want to be better than them. So I want you to go away and come back with a plan you believe in that nobody's doing. And again, that just takes a little bravery and belief in that you might have some good ideas that, and nobody else might be doing it, so you're not going to get validated that way. But by trial and error, whether it be dealing with players during the pandemic or like, look, none of this is, hey, I'm going to go deal with them all in the right way. Like, I'm going to make mistakes along the way and learn and fix it and try and move forward, you know? So I think that's a huge thing is be willing. It keeps coming back to being yourself, but if you feel something's right, try it.
Yeah.
Maybe it isn't. And I've made some big breakthroughs. I feel myself as a coach that way. And when you're doing that, you feel more confident because you're doing what you really believe in instead of what you think you should be believing in because someone else told you to believe in it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, makes perfect sense.
Sorry, I talk too much. On Twitter, I don't know what my handle is. I'm trying to look. I guess I just – oh, it's at @Matt_Wilco6, which is WILCO6. On Instagram, I'll have to look here. I think it's – I don't know if I've ever given one of these out. John, so this is MWILCO23, I believe, MWILCO23, and then Hanover, you can just Google Hanover College Men's Soccer, and we've had some good teams and unbelievable guys and great players and pretty proud of the accomplishments we've had here. But again, kind of wrap up on this, the rewards of coaching are in the connections and the relationships. It's one when you're young, you're into it, you love, yeah, I want to win, blah blah blah. Winning can be fleeting, you know, but the relation, like me getting to talk to you today and stay connected with other guys that I've played with or coached, that's lifelong. And so yeah, those things are the most powerful in the whole thing. Maybe someday, you know, that was impressed upon me about my dad having Dan Gable's picture. Now the goal is maybe someone will have my picture on their wall. And I don't say that egotistically, but if that happens, I don't think I'm Dan Gable, but man, you know, you had a real impact on somebody. And that's the goal. That is the goal. Every single day is to positively impact somebody. Yeah. Hopefully more than just one person. So.
Absolutely. Well, Matt, this has been awesome, and I really do appreciate your time. And in the event that you know, you get to play in your future, I'll be following closely.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk again and stay connected. And I love this dialogue. I learned a lot about myself just verbalizing some of these things, you know? So it's been fun and I'm glad your family's doing well and that you're still involved and not afraid to put your opinion out there. I like that. I learned from that. I don't agree with everything, but I learned from it.
There you go. All right. So, well, we'll talk soon. Okay.
All right, John, take care.
Take care. Bye.
See you.
First, I want to thank the listeners for giving that podcast the listening time that it got. Matt is one of the most introspective people that I have been coached by. Now that I am coaching players myself and I follow Matt and we talk sporadically and now hopefully more regularly, Matt is a very big influence on the way I think, the way I look at parallels in other sports, other parts of life, and draw inspiration or draw lessons or make decisions about my own coaching journey, my own journey as someone who's coaching himself. And the last thing I'll end with is when I was playing for Matt, it wasn't always easy. I didn't get a lot of playing time. I was a player who did everything I could to fulfill a role on the team. And Matt was always supporting me with whatever capacity he could. And one of the things that was apparent to me back then, going on 12, 15 years ago, whatever, was no matter how down on myself I got, no matter how much I was struggling on or off the pitch, or I was trying to make decisions and integrate into a team, Matt was someone who had done it before or had lived it or had experienced it, but he didn't joystick my journey. He was someone who wasn't that far removed from where I was. He wasn't that far removed from where we were as a team. And you could see that he was really working on himself, working on his coaching, working on his craft. And one of my motivating factors when I finally decided I wanted to become a coach myself was to sit down and do a retro of the people in my life who were very influential. And Matt's right up there with some of the best. And I probably don't give him enough credit, but over the years, there have been times on the sideline, times on the training pitch, time in the weight room, time on a run where I think about something he might have said, something he may have not said. And maybe that taught me the lesson. And I think for the listener, if you are a coach yourself or you're a player, you're a parent of a player, it's important to understand that there's so much to this game that is drawn from just looking at something and taking the time to let it sit, let it turn over in your mind, because that's part of this journey that we're on. So anyway, thank you very much for listening. Make sure you check out thesefootballtimes.co and check out the These Football Times magazine edition. Take care. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Coaches Forum by These Football Times. Be sure to check out These Football Times online for some of the best long-form, authentic journalism and football storytelling on offer.